Okay, we go on to case number 2, which is 033734, the estate of Moreland versus Eric Dieter et al. And good morning, Mr. Coons. Good morning. Come on up. I'm sorry.
It pleases the court, counsel for the plaintiffs, and counsel for the co-defendant. Eric Dieter and Michael Sauden bring this appeal from a Section 1983 judgment against them in the amount of $29 million compensatory damages and punitive damages of $15 million against Mr. Sauden and $12.5 million against Mr. Dieter. Mr. Dieter and Mr. Sauden were officers at the St. Joseph County Jail.
Could I ask, though, Mr. Coos, I have actually two questions I want to put on the table right away. First of all, as I understand your brief, you are not making a separate challenge to the amount of the compensatory damages.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And number two, I looked, and it could well be that I just didn't have the time to find it, but is the actual videotape that you are complaining about in the record before this court?
Three, Your Honor, yes.
We have the videotapes here.
If not, they need to be.
They certainly do need to be here because we can't evaluate
anything
pertinent.
And there are three. There are 16, 17, and 18.
I know that there are a bunch of videotapes, and the three that you're complaining about, I couldn't find them in the record here, and as I say, maybe you could double check to make sure, because they certainly were used, as you point out, at the trial.
Yes, they'll be done today, and if they're not here, they will be here immediately or as quickly as I can get them here from the district court.
Okay, thank you.
Taking up from that point, therein lies the crux of the appeal with regard to the use of the tapes and the district court not allowing Dieter and Sauden to put before the jury evidence of their acquittal. The death of Mr. Moreland occurred in 1997. He was a pretrial detainee. He'd been arrested on a DUI charge, came into the jail. There's evidence of altercations outside the jail and evidence of two altercations in the jail on the first floor involving a co-defendant by the name of Sergeant Maffa, where there was in the drunk tank, there was what I would characterize, I think, fairly as a fight between Mr. Moreland, Sergeant Maffa, and another officer, not a defendant in this case, by the name of Holovet.
Right. Forgive me, but I would like to just go back to the tapes for one moment, and even before we have the opportunity to view them, ask you this. Because it sounds like you consciously made a decision not to take the district court up on its offer of wide latitude in cross-examining the interrogators who appeared on the tape. And, you know, from the briefs, it would seem that you realized that strategy failed, and that you would like a second bite at the apple. And what I would like to know, and I think it would help us while watching the tape, why should we take that in action as anything other than a waiver?
Because it wasn't a waiver. Prior to trial, about 3 weeks, Your Honor, I filed the objection to the use of the tapes, anticipating they were going to be used. I cited specific commentary in the tapes. That objection was denied by the district court approximately 2 weeks before the trial, with the caveat that I could reopen it outside the presence of the jury. The first day of trial, or actually pre-trial, there were motions in limine filed by the plaintiffs. One of them was to prohibit the introduction of evidence of the acquittal in the civil rights criminal case. The judge invited discussion. Both sides contributed. And at the conclusion of that discussion, the judge said, we will see about other matters concerning the tapes, but he was going to keep out, at least at that point in time, an introduction of the evidence concerning the acquittal. The next thing that happened was the insertion of the videotape into the tape recording machine. Nothing else. No witnesses. That was it. Now, you saw from the record, the district court judge, I objected. District court judge said, is this the tape you're going to play? Plaintiff's counsel said, this is it. It is my position that the district court judge was not prepared to hear that tape. He had given me an opportunity at some later time outside the presence of the jury to discuss it. But then, when the tape was offered, I objected. I objected on two grounds. The ones that I had raised in the motion that had been denied, and we had talked about this acquittal. And there was a colloquy of several pages where I was concerned about the acquittal not coming in when they were going to get these interrogation tapes.
But, you know, acquittals, I mean, there are a couple of points I want to ask you. One, it seems to me right now, this is the impression anyway I got from your brief, is that your focus has been more in the Rule 403 theory than the hearsay theory. And my second, so if you can clarify if that's true, and secondly, it seems to me that it's routine not to admit evidence of acquittals like this because a jury will misunderstand it. An acquittal means that someone was not found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, obviously. And the standard is different in a civil trial. So I am not sure under what circumstances you could find a case where such an acquittal was admitted. How could we say this was an abuse of discretion on the part of the judge?
I think this is that case, and let me just.
But why did it show anything other than, I mean, you know, unless, other than giving the jury, you know, a Crim Pro 1 course, which they might not pay any attention to anyway, why wasn't the judge doing what was absolutely routine?
Because these tapes are not statements of the defendant.
The defendant says some things. I realize your point is that the interrogators say some things, too.
But, Your Honor, the defendants deny the allegations. But the allegations are laid out in fairly long statements, and upon review of it, I don't think anyone can deny it. These are interrogation tapes. They're interrogation techniques. But they lay out specifically that these interrogators had heard from inmates, and they believed the inmates, what the inmates said were true, and now, what have you got to say about that? It is unique. There's no question that the issue of acquittal would be routinely kept out, but not in this case. This is the very first piece of evidence. There's no foundation laid. It's inserted. The jury is allowed to hear things that come from the investigators rather than from the defendants, and they are not in context.
But then why wouldn't you have questioned them so that the jury could understand their interrogation method?
I saw that in the response brief. I can only tell you, Your Honor, a year before, these two officers had not achieved their stated goal, is to convict these two individuals of civil rights violations. It is, from my perspective, a difficult, and more appropriately from my perspective, not a remedy to put those officers in and expect them to testify in the civil case that they were using techniques. The problem with the tapes, and once the tapes are reviewed, it's very obvious the defendants deny the inquiry. They are denying it. Eric Dieter denies it. Now, Mr. Sauden,
when you say denies the inquiry,
He denies the allegations
of
the brutality. And understanding this, these tapes go on, and we have transcripts of the tapes, and I'll submit those as well. The tapes are the real thing because the tapes show how the people reacted. The problem with the tapes, from our perspective, is that once they're put in, the damage is done. The district court did not do what could have been done. He deferred, the district court deferred and said, I'll take it up at a later time. I on behalf of Dieter and Sauden cited what the problems were, and when he deferred, I think he thought we'd have time for it, and here comes the tape, and then he denied it. At that time...
Well, you didn't say, Judge, this shouldn't be the first thing in, let's get foundation first, or let's...
I objected on foundation, Your Honor.
You did, but the timing... Because I realized that they were the first thing out of the box, but... I'm just concerned.
Well,
your objection here, just to get back to my other point, seems to me basically Rule 403, because nobody is saying that the interrogator's questions are being admitted for the truth. You didn't ask for limiting instruction. That's tactics, and maybe you thought that was a bad idea, but nonetheless, I don't think there's much to the hearsay point. It's really the prejudice point that you're trying to make.
I agree.
Okay.
And I pointed out in the response brief that we conceded hearsay. I think that it's an exception. But there's
something just came to mind. You conceded that the jury was instructed on how to process the interrogation tapes. And,
no.
You know, we always assume that... follow the instructions that are given them. Did you object to those instructions?
No, I'm sorry if I misled you, Your Honor. The record is clear. I objected to the tapes. I thought the tapes were devastating from that perspective of what these interrogators were saying. When the tape was offered and it was stuck in the machine, that's it, it starts. I objected before it was turned on, and I made the same objection I had done in writing. So that's twice I've objected, and the district court at first deferred and second simply denied it. And then I also objected on the issue, if the tapes come in, I would like to have the opportunity to talk about acquittal. Now, we talked about that before the discussion on inserting the tapes. So now I'm presented on behalf of Dieter and Sauden with these criminal investigation tapes, where I don't have this opportunity to go before the jury, and I objected. I don't have now this time to go before the jury. That's the point that we're making on the appeal. And because of what was said there, it's set in stone. At that point in time, the very first piece of evidence is that we've got two officers that are interrogating Dieter and Sauden, and there were three tapes used, 16 is Sauden's third interrogation on video, and then 17 and 18 are Dieter's first and second. But at that point in time, the jury hears this tape, and they are instructed, or at least, strike that, not instructed, they are informed by the speaker that we've heard all of these things that happened on your floor from the inmates, and the comments are, and something had to happen.
But why does that matter, given all the other evidence that came in at the trial? The jury heard from all of these inmates.
Yes.
It heard directly.
Okay.
In the end, what's the difference?
The difference is because of the obvious discrepancies of those inmates in their testimony. And I pointed out
that in your brief.
I think there were seven. And they are not slight discrepancies, Your Honor. What they are is one is saying, I saw somebody else other than Dieter and Sauden. Another one says, I saw somebody I think was Dieter, but it didn't look like him. Another one says, I saw him drag him out by his hand. Another person says, I saw him drag him out by his feet. Two people say, we saw him pick him up and throw him in. Another person, they both did it. Another person said, one person threw him in. I mean, these... understanding that this is trial and this is evidence, but this is, it follows what the interrogator's theory was. And it's Dieter and Sauden's position, they don't mind the trial, they don't mind going to the trial, but having the criminal trial inserted at the beginning, and then not having the information on the acquittal brought forward, and the jury coming back, and yes, all of these same people testified, every one of them. But the problem with their testimony was that it was of such the discrepancies were so obvious, and I pointed them out at final argument, but and the jury chose to disbelieve them. We think it's because of the prejudice from the insertion of the tape. The issue concerning the tapes not being objected to, I think, therefore, I've covered. I see my time is out, and I will rest on the pleadings with regard to Issue 2 and 3.
Thank you. Thank
yes,
you.
Ma'am.
Thank you. Mr. Feiger?
Thank you.
How much time does Mr. Feiger have?
How can that be?
How can that be?
The appellees have 15. He wrote it down, I know, but
forgive us.
Okay.
Little housekeeping. Do you have anything more you want to say now? I'm going to give you some extra time. The way this was divided up is not quite correct. Do you want to do it now, or do you? Yes. Sorry, Mr. Feiger.
That's all right. As long as we're just discussing that, you might consider the fact. And I agree with you, it seems to be a little unfair.
Yeah.
We also have a cross appeal.
Oh, we know that.
And so...
That's why you have all this time. That's why you have all this time, but it's still...
Okay.
Yeah.
And we attempted to file a reply brief that inexplicably we weren't permitted to respond to either. I don't know if the court knew that. We were a cross appellant, and I would assume that everyone has the right to file a reply brief as you normally would as an appellant, except we timely filed it and the court refused to accept a reply brief from us.
Okay.
So you might consider that also.
Okay. Let's give you 3 more minutes.
I don't think I'll use it. I wanted to follow up particularly on the line of questioning from Judge Wood. After the tape was inserted and trial began, then there was a series of times where plaintiffs and defendants discussed with the district court the acquittal issue. And it came in the context of the plaintiffs wanting to introduce some documents of the investigation, the criminal investigation. And at that point in time, they did not want to open the door to the issue of acquittal, and they asked the district court judge, would that do it? And the district court judge said no. The tapes then for Eric Dieter were brought in, and the brief for the plaintiff says there was no objection. I asserted an objection, stating, I think it's page 97, volume 3, same objection as before when they attempted to insert Eric Dieter's tapes. Same objection. I want to just conclude with this. The issue concerning the introduction of someone's tape statement revolves around, and its admissibility, revolves around the court's analysis of it, whether it is in context. It is Mr. Dieter and Mr. Sawden's position that these tapes are not in context. They don't put their statements in context. Because of their rambling and interrogation techniques where they're basically haranguing these two people. So the idea that the district judge should have let these in because, well, that's a statement and you can't tell the answers what they mean unless you hear the questions is a little bit, it is inappropriate analysis. The analysis has to be what was said. The second thing on the tapes themselves, that although that they brought in the information with regard to what these officers did, both of the officers denied the allegations of beating and hitting Mr. Moreland in the shower or using the pepper spray in the area of the shower. They both admitted there was a wrestling match outside in the lawyer's room, which everyone knew could not be seen by any of the inmates. So again, these tapes are from a criminal case, and they are devastating to the plaintiffs. And saying I can put on the officers to cross-examine them is a hollow remedy in this context. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Now, good morning again, Mr. Rogers.
Good morning again. Thank you. May it please the court, Jeffrey Feiger, on behalf of the estate of Christopher Moreland, who was tortured and killed in the jail by the defendants Sauden and Dieter, in front of scores of, I hesitate to call them inmates, many of them, all of them are in there on misdemeanor charges. The third floor of this jail, though, was some kind of hellhole in which he was strapped into a restraint chair, sprayed with a chemical weapon repeatedly in the face, and beaten to death and left to die over hours. We had tapes of that.
Let me start you off here. In your cross appeal, you really didn't articulate the policy, formal or informal, that led to Moreland's injury. What I certainly would like to know is, what policy are you relying on?
That's a good question, Your Honor. A custom, not a policy, because in these cases there's virtually always a formal written policy. But in fact, the custom is to avoid and ignore the written policy. And in this case, it's to improperly use restraint chairs and chemical weapons. That is the use they call that. This is pepper spray, OC-10 spray. I can't minimize how strong a weapon this is. This will disable this entire room if sprayed in any place in this room. It will disable every person in this room. And this was repeatedly used on hundreds of occasions within this jail. Despite
where's the evidence of that? Because I understood you to be making what I think of as sort of a part two of Monell kind of argument. But what I didn't see was concrete evidence that this happened all the time in such a way that what was happening now, one could draw the inference that there really was a widespread practice as opposed to simply from time to time. I'm not minimizing what happened, of course, but from time to time, if people disobey a policy, it doesn't mean that the municipality or the other governmental entity has liability.
Yeah, but
where's your evidence?
Well, I think recently this court in the CMS case said you don't get one free kill or one free suicide.
Well, but in that and case, though, there was evidence of routine failure. The word is important.
And there's evidence of routine.
Where?
The Moreland case is so, let me just point out, the Moreland case itself is so egregious.
That doesn't make it a policy, though. That means you get the $29 million against the
No, except the this sheriff did nothing. This department did nothing.
That's not what he says. He says he trained people. He followed all of the recommendations and indeed exceeded them under Indiana law.
And we presented at trial, and there was evidence presented to the court prior to trial of hundreds of instances in which it was used, and in specific instances where people were tied to the restraint chair. There was a Mr. Crone and a Mr. Grimm who actually testified at trial, but whose cases were provided to the district court prior to the motion for summary judgment, in which the same type of occurrences by the same people, Dieter and Sauden, had occurred. And the evidence in this case is that the sheriff simply turned a blind eye to this type of activity within the jail. The jail was
The relevant question is, at summary judgment, had you presented enough evidence to create an issue of material fact on whether it happened so frequently as to amount to a customer usage, or whether in fact there were isolated incidents from time to time when the policy, the written policy, which you concede is okay, wasn't followed?
That's always in the eye of the beholder. The
perpetrator
would always say this is isolated incidences. The victim would say that this is a custom and policy, and that makes it an essential jury question.
No. You've dropped a lot of record sites, but what you haven't told the court is the facts that support your theory that there is this formal or informal policy of excessive force, or a failure to adequately train the officers to handle medical emergencies.
That's correct.
What facts specifically support a claim of failure to train? This is your opportunity because it's not in the brief.
Well, the brief misstates one thing, and I apologize, Your Honor. The brief misstates Deputy Albright, who testified that he had witnessed 200 to 300 occurrences at the jail. Now, it says that that was trial testimony. In fact, that was grand jury testimony, and that was testimony that was presented to the court during the motion for summary disposition, summary judgment.
Counsel, occurrences of what? Use of OC spray or
yeah.
something else?
Occurrences, use of OC 10 spray.
OC 10 spray didn't kill Mr. Moreland.
Well, I'm not sure it didn't kill him, but it tortures him. OC 10 spray being sprayed in the face is torture. No one could justifiably spray anyone while restrained into a chair with OC 10 spray except to torture them. That is not a legitimate use of the weapon.
And there was evidence in the summary judgment record that there had been prior instances of the use of OC spray against a restrained?
Daniel Grimm, Robert Coron, C-O-A-R-O-N, specifically, and just Spybrook knew about it, and it had occurred. And in fact, Mr. Grimm testified at trial, although the evidence was presented to the district court at the summary judgment motion. Mr. Grimm testified. The facts were identical. They were parallel. He was strapped into a chair. Dieter and Sauden came up to him and sprayed him directly in the face with OC-10 spray. So this was not, these are facts from which a trier of fact could conclude that this is not an isolated, a one-time only occurrence, but in fact this is a custom which has been permitted to be repeated over and over again. And I think this is an essential question of fact. And I what's so troubling here, more to the point, is I don't think any legitimate reading of the district court's order could divine the reason upon which the district court concluded that there were no judiciable issues of fact.
I'll agree with you on that. Judge Harp gave almost no reasoning.
Did
he have anything to reason?
He most certainly did. In fact, the only fair reading I make of Judge Sharp's ruling is that he concluded, I think erroneously under Monell, that Sheriff Spybrook had to be present and personally involved in the constitutional violations in order to find him liable. And he repeatedly said that at page 5 and 6 of the court's opinion, and I think he's totally wrong in that sense. And I'm glad you began with that, and I'll go on to the other issues. My counsel has presented to you on appeal the issue of the playing of the tapes. I frankly think this is a non-issue. Playing of these tapes, I mean, these are played routinely as admissions in all criminal proceedings.
How were the jury instructed to process the tape? Were they instructed that the questions and comments of the interrogators were not to be accepted for the truth?
Yeah, and that's a very good question. And if they weren't, it's the fault of the attorneys for Dieter and Sauden for not asking for that limiting instruction. But it's clear to me that nobody ever suggested that the questions were to be considered to be the truth of the matter contained therein.
In what sense were they admissions, though, if as Mr. Kuss has argued, that they were just sitting there saying no, you know, or words to that effect? I don't know what they said.
You could hardly conclude that these are declarations against interest as well as admissions. And one...
Do you agree that we don't, at the moment, have the tapes here in this court?
I'm sorry, I wasn't aware of that either. And I would assume the appellant would have made those available.
No, I mean, it will be fixed, I'm sure.
But I can assure you, first of all, that no one can conclude that there's been criminal proceedings at all. As you correctly point, these are just questions being asked by a detective in a police setting. Nobody conclude from that that therefore there has been a criminal proceedings. But notwithstanding that, the fact of criminal proceedings is irrelevant. It's not res judicata, and it's likely, that would be a 403 analysis, it's likely to confuse the jury as to the standard of proofs necessary in the civil rights case versus whatever happened in the criminal case.
So somebody watching this tape could as well think it was simply an internal police inquiry?
Not only could they conclude that, that's exactly what it was, because several of the other tapes are, in fact, they are internal police inquiries. They are done for the internal purposes of the police department. They weren't being done at the behest of the prosecutor. These people were being interviewed by people of their own department to find out what they were doing when Christopher Moreland died. So, in effect, these were fellow employees interviewing each other, saying what had happened. How did this man die? We have reports here from all these people up on the third floor that you tortured them to death. What's your explanation for this?
Was that clear from the tape itself?
Absolutely, 100%. No one, I mean, no one could conclude otherwise. With all due respect, it's not even a question. This is an employee. They're both employees of the Sheriff's Department. Dieter and Sauden are deputy sheriffs. They're employed by the Sheriff's Department, and they're being questioned by other sheriffs about what those guys did up on the third floor. To suggest that this is barred under 403 analysis, it's a barred under hearsay, because no one suggested that Mr. Richmond was in any way saying the truth or that it was to be taken for the truth of the matter contained therein, but simply to put in context Sauden and Dieter's statements. And remember,
so there are different levels of tapes, right? Different
times.
Different.
They were interviewed at different times by members of the
right,
department.
Right, but they're also different levels.
What do you mean?
In other words, some are their own, you know, colleagues.
They're all their old colleagues.
But every last one of them.
Yeah, no, there's no prosecutors or anything like that. It's not anything related to criminal proceedings per se. It's only police interviewing other police.
And there are three cases?
I think there's at least three that I played, two of Dieter and one of Sauden. I think the objection is made to Sauden's. Sauden didn't take the stand. He pled the fifth. He refused to be called. I attempted to call Sauden in the case in chief. Sauden asserted his right against self-incrimination and refused to take the stand. Dieter took the stand, and I think this appeal only centers around Sauden, although Dieter's tapes were played also, and the same could be complained of, although aren't. I'd just like to cover very briefly, again, the constitutional issue on punitive damages. I think that's a non-issue. Having never raised it at the trial court, to assert now that the award under this, the malevolent circumstances which were shown to exist in this case, that the award of punitive damages, which is less than the compensatory award, which is not being contested, is unconstitutional, I don't think it deserves review of any kind whatsoever. And finally, to suggest that Dr. Lustgarten, a board-certified neurosurgeon, could not testify as to the cause and manner of death, that is a subdural hematoma, which was in fact caught the cause of death and found by the
medical
examiner.
You had the coroner or somebody else also testifying? Yes.
The coroner testified, and another learned coroner from Detroit, Michigan, Dr. Werner Spitz, testified that the cause of death was a subdural hematoma. So to suggest that Dr. Lustgarten would be barred under a Daubert analysis because he didn't read, or allegedly didn't read, the self-serving statements of the defendants as to what they claim happened is, I think, a non-issue. I really think I've covered everything that
okay.
I wanted to cover, and I really appreciate your opportunity to provide this to you.
Now, let me just say this. If something comes up that you think is should have been covered by whatever it is you wanted to file and were not permitted to file, you let us know, and we'll give you a minute or two. All right, now, okay.
May it please the court, Mr. Kust, Mr. Feiger. My name is David Ballard, and I am here on behalf of Sheriff Joe Spybrook, who has been sued in his official capacity only. And I think this panel has hit on, right at the outset, that the issue here is whether there has been a showing of deliberate indifference by the sheriff by maintaining a custom or a policy of abuse at the jail.
Mr. Ballard, Judge Sharp really gave us no analysis to review, it seems to me. Shouldn't we at least remand to ask him to state his reasons, to at least discuss some of the evidence before we take this up on appeal?
Well, I think that what this focuses on is what was the record submitted to the trial court at the time. And I think that Judge Sharp said in his order, try as they will, the plaintiffs in this case simply cannot make a jury issue with reference to deliberate indifference based on the record they submitted at the time.
Well, now, they focused on this and toward the end of their brief, of course. And first of all, on page 64, there are these six reported instances of spraying people who were already in a restraint chair. Now, is six a practice? Is 12? Is 100? The page before, they indicate Albright's talking about 300 macings, which does sound like quite a few for inside a jail.
That's what they say in their brief, but that is not what's in the record. Now, they say there are six instances of using this pepper spray on somebody in the chair. They only submitted exhibits of two reports, and only one of those with somebody who was in a restraint chair at the time. Now, the policy on using this spray, this is the next level after physically trying to control someone. And if they're in a situation where somebody's trying to cause harm, the use of the spray itself is not being challenged. The one instance
where what can you do in the chair?
Well, okay, in that one instance that they reported, it was somebody who was in the chair and he had started to come loose from the chair. So while they're trying to buckle him in, he was spitting into their faces. And so they warned him then, stop spitting in our faces or we're going to spray you with this spray. He didn't. He kept spitting on them. And so that's the only instance that they ever brought up of anybody ever being sprayed in the chair. The other instance that they've submitted was an instance where somebody was kicking a door. Again, it's a physical confrontation that they're trying to prevent.
Now, the plaintiffs pointed to two jail employees who did not send Moreland to the hospital because they did not understand they had the authority to do so. That seems like a fairly serious training deficit. Why can't we attribute that problem to the sheriff, who is ultimately charged with the care of these inmates? I mean, he's certainly on notice now that his employees need to be trained to send seriously ill or injured inmates to the hospital.
And Judge, I have those two quotes right here. Again, this is an instance where in the brief they've quoted things out of context, and if I could, I'd like to read the whole quote of where these came from.
Why don't you tell us where they are?
Okay. On Donald Grueler, this is in the plaintiff's appendix at page 522, and it's actually page 23. They quoted him as saying, as far as having any real medical training, the officers have none. We don't even have first aid taught to us anymore. Now, what the whole quote is saying is that, because keep in mind, this is the sheriff had hired out 24-hour on-call medical provision with this Omega Health Group who is on site, and all of these questions that these deputies are being asked are about what they do, because he says, this is what he says earlier, as far as particular guidelines and times, the floor officer, once he's notified the nursing staff, is more or less at their beck and call. If the nurse feels that he should be moved to the area or down to her office or taken to the hospital, we do that. Now, here's what they quoted. As far as having any real medical training, the officers have none. We don't even have first aid taught to us anymore. That's all done at the academy. Now, he cut that out. There is no evidence that these officers have no first aid training. The other snippet that they added was from Tracy Zeitz, which is at the plaintiff's appendix, pages 407 and 408, page 17 and 18 of her testimony. What she was asked was whether the nurse that's employed by this medical group, whether she has the authority to call for an ambulance or whether she has to call her supervisor. And it says, because they asked her, is somebody injured, does she have to call her supervisor? And she says, well, I don't know how their policy works. And that's the two quotes they said. Simon says, you need to go to the hospital, and I just don't know their policy on that.
Who's they?
This is the Omega Health Group. This is the nurse who's on their 24-hour call on the premises. This is this is what the sheriff provided for this jail is having. In fact, this is just like that Woodward case that they filed in their supplemental authority, because that was a third-party contractor who itself can be held to Monell liability when they take this on. And Omega was a party in this case, but they settled out. Most of these claims on medical...
I'm sorry, I still am not clear. When the nurse says, I don't know what their policy is, she's an Omega employee and she's saying she doesn't know what the sheriff's policy
is? No, the deputy is saying, I don't know what the nurse's policy is.
I don't know what Omega...
Omega Health Group is the medical group that provides the doctors and the nurses at the site. Tracy Zeiss is a deputy, and she was asked, can she call an ambulance? And she says, I don't know what their policy is. They run that themselves. What they tell us.
The nurse says, we do what they tell us.
No, that's the deputy saying about the nurse. They ask the deputy, does the nurse have to call for an ambulance or call for a supervisor, or can she call? The deputy says, I don't know what Omega's policy is on that.
Isn't that damning in itself?
No, because as far as the deputies are concerned that are on premises there, they have this medical presence there whose responsibility is to take care of the medical needs. That's why the deputies then don't have to be doctors themselves. The medical people are on there 24 hours, and that's what the sheriff has provided here.
So you're saying that the deputy, ran to get the nurse?
Yes. And that's what they did in all these instances. They brought it to the nurse's attention. The nurse either did or did not call the supervisor, did not call the ambulance.
Is the record going to tell us?
Yes. In fact, that's what all of these are. All of these medical opinions have to do with what the nurses didn't do. These are all the Omega employees that have all settled out already. And so none of that has to do with any of the jail personnel. Now, what they're trying to turn that into is that here we have all these jail personnel that don't know anything. They don't have any training at all. Whereas what this training is they get basic first aid training at the academy. I mean, they have basic understanding, but when you have the doctors there on site, you're naturally going to defer to them and let them make the call and let them make the decisions, because that's what they're there for. And so that's examples of what they've done in this brief, of where they're trying to take things out of testimony, whereas everything in this case is that, and again, this is just the record that was presented to the summary judgment, is that everything they've alleged in here is at the most an isolated incident. As far as all of these instances of reviewing the spraying of the pepper spray, none of those other than this one had anything to do with a restraint chair. There's no evidence of any
other than the other one, Mr. Corin.
Right, other than that one, but that was somebody who was, he wasn't trying to hit them, but he was trying to batter them by spitting at them. In all of these instances, they've never shown any other examples of pretrial detainees that have been denied medical care, that have been left to sit. They've never showed any prior instances that other people had problems in calling for medical assistance. They never showed any prior instances of anybody even being beat up by deputies. None of this, they've never tried to attach to the sheriff, of what the sheriff is aware of, or that he was deliberately indifferent to an existing problem that was going on.
Did the summary judgment record contain the statistics about the number of uses of OC spray
Yes. In
the years immediately?
There were 3 years of statistics. Each of those 3 years leading up to this date, they went down. In fact, those numbers were 128 instances, then 73 instances, then only 17 in 1997. However, the only evidence they put on that is that those were just instances where it's used. Even their expert says, I don't have any information as to what went on in those cases, so I don't know whether they were proper or improper. Now, they would like to create the suggestion that using pepper spray at all is improper, but that's been an accepted policy on the use of force on their gradated scale, and they're not questioning of having a policy of using the pepper spray. They're just saying that in this instance it was abused. And again, whether or not it was doesn't have to do with us, because that was a trial, but they've offered up no other instances of where it has been abused in this manner sufficient to put the sheriff on notice that there's a problem with any of this. And this is the same thing with regard to the medical testimony. There have been no other instances of any other pretrial detainees that have either been denied medical care or ignored. And other than that, unless the panel has any questions, that's what the focus is on this record, submitted to this trial court, which has been included in this brief.
The two instances of alleged misuse of OC spray that were in the summary judgment record, did those involve the defendants?
I don't know, but I think I heard him say that just the one did, and that would have been the spitting, which again is responding to a physical battery, but that's just one instance.
I think what my sister is asking you is either of the two defendants here.
And that I don't know, but they will be reflected in the reports that are in the record. Thank you very much.
All right. By the way, I am going to allow you to file your brief.
Could I add just one thing on that?
Of course.
And again, as far as what they had attempted to file in a reply brief, they filed two supplemental designations of authority that have included all of that same authority that they wanted to put in their reply brief, and that all came in last week and this week.
Thank you.
One counsel for Sheriff Spybrook says, well, he's got hundreds of instances, but he can't show us where we were abusing it. In the record given to Judge Sharp was an order sent out prior to Chris Moreland dying saying, you people aren't filling out jail reports. So we know there are hundreds of people being sprayed, but they were required to fill out reports. What they did to these people, they weren't doing it. So Spybrook knew that his own staff wasn't filling out the reports, and on July the 10th, 1997, and this is in the record, Spybrook sends out through his deputy a letter to all the employees saying, you have to fill out reports. So we have statistics, but the jail itself knew that it wasn't reporting what they were doing. In other words, what was really happening, how many people were tied to a chair. Secondly, Sheriff Spybrook hires Omega. He can't insulate himself by hiring Omega. In this particular case, they throw everything off on the nurse. Counsel just read you, if the nurse feels she should be moved down to this area or down to the office or taken to the hospital, we do that. As far as having any medical training, the officers have none. We don't even have first aid taught to us anymore. In this case, the nurse was a lady called Nurse Connie. Nurse Connie wasn't a nurse. Nurse Connie was only licensed in the state of Indiana to pass out pills. And their defense in this case was Nurse Connie didn't take an unconscious...
Was she an LPN?
No, she wasn't anything. She wasn't a nurse. I kid you not. She was an aide who was licensed to only pass out pills. And their excuse in the trial was the reason we didn't take Christopher Moreland strapped to a chair and dying of a subdural hematoma was Nurse Connie didn't tell us to. A nurse who isn't a nurse, who isn't licensed to do anything except pass out pills. That was the nurse in the jail that the jail says we defer to her. That was the nurse.
Well, Mr. Fracker, do you think we ought to remand to Judge Sharp for some reasoning here?
You could, at the very minimum, but Judge Sharp, I think, gives you enough of a context, because when he says that he thinks Sheriff Spybrook had to be personally involved in order to find a Monell violation, I think he gives you evidence of the fact that I think he's off track on this issue. There is a plethora of evidence that should be presented to a jury on the issue of whether there's been a Monell violation by virtue of a customer policy. At a minimum, though, Your Honor, yes.
Thank you. Will you file your brief within 7 days?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
The issue concerning the tapes, I think, will be resolved by viewing the tapes. I wanted to clear up one point. These are not yes or no. I think Judge Rover, you may have asked if yes or no. These are not yes or no responses. These are explanations, but there's a lot of no's and yeses, but the point is they aren't admissions against interest. Now, I would argue differently. Plaintiffs may pick things out, but in the end, after you review the tapes, both tapes of Dieter, he denies any of the allegations of what happened with pepper spray, what happened in the shower, what happened in front of the tower. He says, and he always has, that there was a wrestling match when Mr. Moreland was fighting to put the cuffs on, but that was outside the presence, outside the view of all the inmates. Mr. Sawden says, he admits, yeah, I threw water on him from the white bucket. I threw water on him, and he says, yeah, and then there was this wrestling match where we had to cuff him. But that, again, is outside. So I think that is the issue that...
That is outside what? The record or what?
No, that's in the record. It's what? Outside. I'm sorry, that's outside the view of these inmates.
Okay.
In other words, I'm getting back to this issue. Inserting that tape at the beginning of a trial without foundation, and a judge having been given a heads up, chapter and verse, and then he deferred and then he allowed it in, placed my clients with having that stamp of approval by these questioners. And it's very clear that they are officers and they're investigating criminal conduct. And we thought appropriately, if they're going to put that in, there ought to be foundation, and that it shouldn't first go in, but if it should, there should be evidence of the acquittal coming in. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, thanks to all the parties. And the case will be taken under advisement.